Chapter 1. Opening quote by Rachel Naomi Riemann, MD. We are all here for a single purpose, to grow in wisdom and to love better. We can do this through losing as well as through winning, by having and by not having, by succeeding or by failing. All we need to do is to show up open-hearted for class. Chapter 1 Title: Accessing the Hero Within, A Paradoxical Process. No one taught me how to fail. No one showed me how to lose. And because I never learned these things, I felt alone when they occurred. Sometimes I felt more than alone. I felt incompetent if I didn't win. I felt rejected if I wasn't the chosen favorite. I felt worthless or guilty if I couldn't please someone. Certainly, I never considered opening my heart for a class on how to experience losing and failing. Winning and success have also been mine. Some achievements came from blind determination and relentless work. Other successes came my way because of sheer luck or the fortune of those around me. However, my real successes, the ones that give me the most personal fulfillment, have come from opening up to my losings, not havings, and failings. I spent the first half of my life running away from them. I've spent the last half learning how to show up for the hidden lessons they contain. I discovered that, paradoxically, the things I had been so fearfully fleeing were the very things that would free me to grow into my larger self. I learned these secrets from people I admired. I realized they knew something that I did not. When I looked very carefully at what set them apart, it was that they knew how to lose and fail. They had not learned these traits from educational systems or advertisements. Schools tell us how to succeed. They show us how to hold on and control. Likewise, advertisements don't show us how to let go of people, places, or things. In fact, they teach us just the opposite. We can have it all. More is better. And we can do whatever we want. Ads create a no-need-to-fail illusion that we are seduced into believing is true. It's no wonder that we feel like losers when we discover that we can't have it all. More does not make us happier, and that we can't do whatever we want. This book seeks to counter that illusion. The people you are going to read about on these pages have allowed themselves to encounter failure. They even use it to reach depths within themselves. This deeper aspect of self that they access sometimes seems mysterious to me. Some people might call this deeper self the soul. Others might call it the self, the divine spark, or the kingdom of God within. I call it the hero within, because it is the place inside ourselves that touches God. This inner giant is like the giant oak tree mapped within the proverbial acorn, an imprinted destiny or purpose that we are born to fulfill if we have the honesty, courage, and humility to do so. I've come to realize that each of us possesses this goal-directed vitality that tries to grow the seed of ourselves into fruition. What I notice about the heroes in my life is that they allow the destiny imprinted in their personhood to mold and shape their lives. As they learn to trust this vision and rely on the inward vitality to attain it, they become less dependent on other people's approval, appreciation, love, and acceptance. Whether or not they are afraid also becomes less and less relevant. What becomes more relevant is living from a place of deep integrity. Rather than becoming broken down by their hardships, my heroes are broken open. They show me how to successfully encounter failure and loss so I can develop resiliency. You will meet my heroes on these pages. You will encounter people who show us how to stop running from painful experiences, They invite us to open up to hardship so we can redeem our suffering with lessons that help us manifest the unique destinies we were born to fulfill. Then we can inhabit ourselves more completely. Carefully scrutinizing these heroes, I realized that trials and tribulations offer us opportunities to develop qualities that can help us become more our true selves. To solve complex personal problems, we learn to let go of the illusion that the problem doesn't exist or that we aren't contributing to it so that we can live honestly. To have life-giving relationships with others, we develop the courage to speak authentically without fear of disapproval. Illness and aging help us let go of pride and vanity so we can develop the quality of humility. Whether they were my patients or people in my personal life, I have noted common patterns and processes described above. Through stories, explanations, and the proper tools, I hope to articulate these processes so that readers will be able to use them, because within our depths, a hero is waiting to be born. Accessing the hero is a rather straightforward process, but it requires honesty, courage, and humility to do so. Although the process is simple, it is not easy. When we complete the process, however, we redeem our destiny. We materialize our God-given potential by expanding into our full capacity. Chapter subheading, John's Destiny and Its Redemption. One of my patients, John, highlights the process. By most anyone's definition, John was a failure. He had been an alcoholic since age 13. Rather than feel painful experiences, John numbed distressing emotions with alcohol. Because of his drinking habits, he had not achieved much success in his career or his relationships. In fact, he had a 6-year-old son he had not even met. When John was 37 years old, he lost his health. He was diagnosed with stomach cancer. His father and grandfather had also died of the disease at young ages. John plunged into despair. However, his poor health served as the wake-up call he needed to get his life on track. The first thing John did was stop drinking. Sober and confronting a life-threatening illness, he saw things anew, and he opened up to his bleak and tumultuous feelings. His priorities shifted. He contacted his son's mother, Donna, and made arrangements to meet his son, Bailey. John and Donna had been in love, and they found their feelings were still the same when they reunited. A few months later, they decided to marry. John moved his new family to Florida so he could be near the VA where he received his chemotherapy treatments. I met John on one of his numerous readmissions to the hospital for complications from his illness. He said to me, "Cancer saved my life." He had a newfound innocence. He was no longer afraid to encounter distressing feelings, so he had no need to numb them with alcohol. His new world looked very different. Not only did he now have a wife and son to share his life, but also he formed stronger bonds with his widowed mother and his 4 sisters. He also became an active member of our cancer support group, helping other patients, quote unquote, save their lives. John also had moments of despair and loneliness. He told me about a recurring nightmare he had been having. He said, "This grotesque-looking travel agent keeps asking me what I want. I keep dodging her, but she always manages to find me. I wake up trembling." I often use imagery from dreams to help people understand experiences that they may be avoiding. So I said to John, "Next time you should ask the travel agent what she wants. Let's try it right now while you're awake and I'm with you. Close your eyes." Quietly, I said, "Bring her image to your mind now." I waited until he had done that. Then I suggested that he tell her that the next time that she came, he was going to ask her what she wanted. John sat quietly for a few moments before opening his eyes and nodding. I said, "If you don't ask her in the dream, ask her as soon as you wake up. Stay in that twilight sleep of a relaxed frame of mind and ask her what she wants. See what impressions come to your mind. A few weeks later, John came to tell me that the travel agent had visited him in the night. With fascination, I asked, "What'd she tell you?" I should have been prepared for his answer, but I wasn't. He told me, "She said she wanted to help me get ready for my trip. She wanted me to be comfortable. She asked what I needed." My heart sank as I realized what his trip meant, that it meant his own death. Warily, I asked him, "How do you feel about what she just told you?" He said, "Good. I'd never thought of her coming to help me. I only thought she was coming to take something away. Now I know I don't need to be afraid of her." My disappointment with my realization that John would soon be facing death turned into hope as we talked about what he needed to get ready for his quote-unquote trip, focusing on end-of-life strategies that would successfully prepare him. Understandably, most of John's concerns focused on preparing his now 8-year-old son for his death. He didn't want Bailey to repeat his own mistakes. He was especially hopeful that he could provide some guidance for Bailey's sexual maturity. As John put it, "That's when a boy really needs his father." John wanted to compress a lifetime of fatherhood into their remaining months together. John made a videotape teaching Bailey how to shave and tie a tie, along with other fatherly advices he would not be able to provide in person. I also helped him write 6 letters that Donna was to give their son at milestones in Bailey's life. These are some excerpts from each letter. "Dear Bailey, you have to remember not to go anywhere until your homework is done. Also, do the extra credit because it's like that magic card in the pocket you can redeem if the dog eats your homework. I hope you'll always learn that others can take a lot of things away from you, but they can't take away your education. I want you to remember not to compare yourself to others, but to do your best. Remember to pick good classes that will keep you interested. Consider science club. You always said you liked space. Go to the planetarium. Ask for a tutor if you need one. Find people who will help you. Lots of people want you to excel. Want that for yourself. Schools are wild now. You will have many temptations. Be strong enough to resist the temptation so you don't betray yourself or undermine your goals. I want you to read this letter at the start of each school year from now on." Next letter. "Dear Bailey, you're probably getting taller now and getting some hair on your body. Your penis may be growing, although it may not be as big as you want. Don't let anyone tease you about it. I remember taking a shower with a bunch of boys and trying to pull on mine to make it look longer. Now I realize I need not compare myself with anyone else. I know you're not kissing girls yet, but you prepare by learning how to shave without razor stubble. Girls don't like razor stubble. You have to respect girls, Bailey. Love is not a game. Sex is not a game. God gave sex and love as a gift of pleasure. If you're going to start seeing a girl seriously, ask to meet her parents. That's a courtesy you should provide. Your virginity is a gift, and it's not going to go away unless you give it away. My advice to you is to wait for sex, and don't give your love to just anyone. That would be irresponsible. At least wait until you're in college, even better, until you marry. Sex can change everything. There are lots of other ways to sexually express yourself than intercourse. You are the one who will suffer the consequences of poor sexual choices, so be prepared for the consequences if you make poor choices." Next letter. "Dear Bailey, I'm going to be watching over you. If you try to smoke, I'll be saying, 'No, no, no,' in your ear. Smoking is one thing that will keep you from blowing out your candles. If you get a car, I hope you will always remember that it's a privilege. A policeman or a court can take that privilege away. So follow the rules, including the golden rule. You see, when you have a car, you have a lot of mature decisions to make." Next letter. "Dear Bailey, I hope this marriage is not a spur-of-the-moment decision and that you've put a lot of thought into it. A bad marriage is hard to deal with. Don't do it if you're not prepared to do it for the rest of your life. Good communication skills are important. Talk about the little things like, would you ever consider living in Alaska? Make sure you can compromise on issues. Be like the reed that can bend with the winds. I wish you a long and happy marriage with lots of children. Give my love and hello to your bride-to-be. Anytime you need me, if God will let me interfere, I'll be there. I wish you both all the happiness life has to offer. Next letter. Dear Bailey, congratulations. I hope and pray your baby is healthy and well and that you understand the miracle you've been handed and the responsibility you are about to undertake. If there are potholes in the road or if the child needs special care, I send even more prayers for healing your way. I hope you are happy parents because then you'll raise happy children. I hope your children bring you as much joy as you have brought me during these few years we had together. You can't see me, but I'm not far away. If there are any trials with your kids, I'll pray to God that you find the help you need. Don't be afraid to ask for help. Next letter. Dear Bailey, this is the last letter you will receive from me. I haven't had the wit of Johnny Carson or the love of Mother Teresa, but I do pray. I pray that in the place where there is extra love, that you will use it to shine a light on someone in the dark today who has forgotten that God is in their heart. I pray for people who want help. Since I first met you, Bailey, you told me that when you grew up, you wanted to help people who are in trouble. I hope you have continued to keep that mission, and if you haven't, that you might reconsider it now. It will bring you much peace, meaning, and fulfillment for your life. John died a few weeks after these letters were written. I attended his memorial service. Chaplain Dan invited people to speak. As others shared their thoughts, I thought carefully about the many lessons John had taught me. Then I shared my musings with his family, saying, if John had died 3 years ago, he would have just sort of fallen off the face of this earth. Many probably would have written him off as an alcoholic who got lost in his unused life. However, John's life changed these last 3 years. He used his loss of health as a means to wake up to the joys and despairs in his life. As a result, John learned how to love. And once he experienced love, his world changed and our world changed. He redeemed the mess he had created in his life. John always said, "Cancer saved my life." But I think what really saved his life was courage. John used cancer to summon courage so he could heal his brokenness. John didn't heal his life in spite of his cancer. He healed his life because of his cancer. Everyone here today bears witness to the hero that John became. He achieved the destiny you all knew that he was born to fulfill. May we each leave here letting John's example influence our own lives. May we each summon the courage to confront our own wounds so they can be used as sources of healing for ourselves and others. May we each change in the ways that we need so that we can fulfill our own destiny. I still think about John. Had it not been for cancer, there is little doubt that John would still be living the life of a desperate man. Had he not accessed his interior hero, there is little doubt that he would have also died a desperate man. I also think about Bailey. I think about the hole in his heart that is healed each time he reads another letter from his father. I also think about the hole in Bailey's heart that would still be there today if his father hadn't written those letters. Chapter subtitle, Redeeming Our Destiny by Accessing the Hero Within. I have had an advantage that most people have not had. I have worked for 30 years with people who are dying. Just like John's story demonstrates, possibilities for growth and expansion accelerate as death approaches. Dying people become fertile ground for healing. One reason this occurs is because perceptions of time change. We all know the phenomenon of the person who says after surviving a potentially fatal accident, "My whole life flashed before me." Past, present, and future are no longer experienced as sequential at the moment of the accident. Rather, they collapse into the ever-present now. Experiencing the eternity of the ever-present now is one of the gifts death offers. It's an inward space where past, present, and future coexist. This experience is very different from trying to block the past or defer plans for the future in order to live in the quote-unquote present moment. People who are aging often experience the eternity of the ever-present now, not in a flash, but in a process of reflection. Elders don't, quote-unquote, live in the past. The past lives in the now, offering opportunities for insight and healing. They review their lives to see what lessons they have learned or what meaning their life contains. It is a natural search for insight before they let go of their earthly existence. Not all people use life-threatening illnesses to discover meaning the way John did. There are various reactions to serious illness, and these reactions have always intrigued me. I notice that some patients crumble under a grim diagnosis, becoming passive and fatalistic. Other patients fight the illness. The disease becomes an adversary they are determined to defeat, using positive thinking, denial, and sheer grit to bolster their morale so they can, quote-unquote, rise above it and go about their lives as if nothing has changed. However, there is a third group of patients who are like John. They neither cave into the disease nor fight it. Rather, they use their disease as a way to encounter life in a larger way. They heal broken relationships and express love and gratitude to others. Though they might be pensive, they are also humorous and even lighthearted. Their outward circumstance does not dictate their inward experience. In fact, it only deepens it. Rather than fearing their disease, they open up to it. Although sadness and sometimes loneliness may be part of their illness experience, so are wisdom and serenity. Some of the patients in this latter group come by these qualities naturally. They have learned how to successfully suffer hardships from previous life experiences, and fear no longer controls them. For others, the trajectory is not smooth, but takes an up and down course. They struggle with moments of despair and loneliness. Rather than running from these moments, they use them as a passageway into the reality of their humanity, encountering their interior hero in the process. These are the patients I watched and let touch my soul so I could learn how to successfully suffer hardships in my own life. Chapter subheading, A Three-Step Process. I have come to conceptualize a three-step process that facilitates access to the hero within each of us. I will describe the process in detail in subsequent chapters. However, I will outline them here using John as an example. The three steps are, number one, abiding, which means showing up open-heartedly to all of the emotional dimensions of life, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and more importantly, embracing the part of self that is experiencing that feeling. Number two, reckoning, which means changing our relationship to problematic situations, relationships, or aspects of self by cultivating the honesty, courage, and humility to face the source of distress. And number three, beholding, which is experiencing a newfound peace with the circumstance because the relationship to the problem has shifted. Chapter subheading, Abiding. Abiding is more than just feeling an emotion. It includes embracing the part of ourselves that is generating the feeling. Most of us know how to abide with experiences that make us feel happy, hopeful, or loving. We open up to the part of self experiencing these feelings and let ourselves wholeheartedly laugh and relax and smile. It's more difficult to abide with, quote-unquote, negative feelings, such as fear, grief, anger, helplessness, or loneliness. Rather than open up to these experiences, we often numb them with denial, illusion, alcohol, workaholism, and other kinds of addictions or compulsions. Addictions, compulsions, and illusions make us smaller than who we are destined to be, because the part of self covered up by the illusions and compulsions become isolated in fear and can't contribute to the integrity of the conscious self. Abiding has two directional focuses. Focused inward, abiding allows us to encounter ourselves. Focused outward, abiding allows us to vicariously experience the emotional dimension of others. When turned inward, abiding requires that we open ourselves to our inner experience, no matter what. In fact, one definition of the word abide is, quote, to stand fast, end of quote. Thus, abiding means I stand fast with all parts of myself, even those parts that feel bad feelings, such as grief, helplessness, fear, and loneliness. I don't abandon or numb the aspects of self with these emotions, nor do I banish them into an imaginary non-existence. When we shut ourselves off from feelings, including the bad ones, we lose the part of self that is experiencing them. This is a serious loss. Focused outward, abiding brings a different dimension to our relationships. The process transforms an empathetic relationship into an abiding presence. This distinction is important. The dictionary defines empathy as, quote, the intellectual identification of oneself with another, end of quote. Abiding includes this meaning and more. It includes heart identification as well. Abiding means I stand with you in your suffering, even if I can't identify with it personally. I'm willing to feel your distress with you. I won't emotionally flee. Abiding your distress also means I'm willing to encounter any personal distress that your situation triggers. With John, abiding began when he stopped numbing his despair and other so-called negative emotions with alcohol. Instead, he opened up to his distress. Once he let himself abide the despair that this aspect of self was experiencing, he used the despair to encounter the meaninglessness in his life. Opening up to despair transported him into a place within his soul that birthed meaning, allowing the despairing, forsaken aspect of self to come home. I also used the abiding process with John so I could encounter his personhood. This process required more than actively listening to him. It required that I vicariously experience him emotionally. I had to let myself abide the part of myself that was grieving John's anticipated death. Abiding requires me to engage my own beingness. My willingness to engage my own beingness helped provide John with emotional safety so he could explore his own feelings. Chapter subheading, Reckoning. Whereas abiding is a journey of the heart, reckoning is a journey of the head. Reckoning requires that we change. It's a willingness to change our relationship to problematic situations, relationships, or aspects of self by cultivating the honesty, courage, and humility to face the source of distress. Change requires us to do two things. We must let go of our current relationship to the problem and open up to the uncertainty of something new and different. This is not always easy to do, which is why the development of honesty, courage, and humility is essential for the reckoning process. Reckoning should not be confused with coping. They are distinctly different processes. The dictionary defines the word cope as, quote-unquote, to deal with problems. The dictionary defines reckoning as an accounting, a getting to the bottom line, a line that often lies below surface consciousness. For example, John had spent 25 years coping with his problems by drinking alcohol. Once he was diagnosed with cancer, however, he decided to reckon with what was causing him to drink in the first place. Instead of being the victim of circumstances that caused him to escape into alcoholism, he decided to change his relationship to his past. He asked forgiveness from Donna and Bailey for abandoning them. He sorted out what was important from what was not. He took steps to regain his integrity so that his destiny could be redeemed. He summoned the honesty, courage, and humility to redeem his suffering. Tools are often needed to help us reckon with the difficulties in our lives. As John demonstrates, forgiveness is often an essential ingredient of the reckoning process. Letter writing can also be used to discover deeper dimensions the way John did. Forgiveness and letter writing help us achieve integrity. These tools will be described in detail in chapters 6 and 7. Dream analysis, like the travel agent chasing John, and mythological stories can also be helpful. They are surprisingly easy tools to use once we value their effectiveness and then practice using them personally. Chapter subheading, Beholding. The result of abiding and reckoning with hardships is what I call beholding. That is, experiencing a newfound peace with the circumstance because the relationship to the problem has shifted. Once the shift has occurred, we receive energy from a deeper aspect of self, and our integrity is restored. The situation may not be any different, but the relationship to the situation shifts with insight and new meaning. People often verbalize their experience of this shift by saying something like, "A load was lifted off my shoulders." John's statement of, "Cancer saved my life," reflects this shift in meaning. When this shift occurred, John received energy from a deeper place within himself. Recognizing and acknowledging this new meaning helped him act from a dimension of integrity. It also helped him gain confidence in tackling other problems because he learned how to trust resources beyond himself. The definition of the word behold is, quote unquote, to see or look at. Beholding, as I'm using it, means more than this definition. It means developing inner vision. It requires using one's soul to see. Thus, when we develop the honesty, courage, and humility to abide the effects of our past and reckon with the cause of our current distress, then we are able to behold a future filled with hope. Peace replaces chaos and pain. In other words, we experience healing. Chapter subheading, Universal Application. I believe that we are born whole, with an imprinted destiny we are designed to fulfill. Each time we close down to a feeling that we don't like, the part of self experiencing the feeling is disconnected from the whole. We lose our integrity by closing ourselves off from the message the silenced self is trying to tell us so it can be rejoined to the conscious self. We turn away from the very piece of self that we need to be facing. More importantly, we lose the energy of this exiled self. Failing to gather these lost pieces of self means we do not inhabit ourselves completely. To the extent that we don't completely inhabit ourselves, we live an unused life. The abiding, reckoning, and beholding processes facilitate gathering these lost pieces of self so they can be welcomed back home and we can regain our integrity. After you read this book, my hope is that each reader will understand and value the abiding, reckoning, and beholding processes so they can be used to redeem the suffering you have experienced. In redeeming your suffering, you will need to access the hero within yourself. This book will provide you with the tools to find your hero. It will be up to you to cultivate a willingness to develop the honesty, courage, and humility to make the inward journey. This willingness often comes as you participate in the process. You will then be able to use what you learn to completely encounter all parts of yourself. This process will allow you to grow into aspects of yourself that you were previously reluctant to inhabit. You can then use the process to heal abuse, bring peace to broken relationships, lose weight, face death, or any challenging situation. From small, everyday problems to overwhelming dilemmas, you will become empowered. Unlike many self-help tactics, this book will not teach you how to overcome, endure, rise above, or transcend problems. Rather, you will learn how to use the problem or limitation to transport you into deeper places within yourself, to cultivate qualities that will open you to energy beyond yourself. Instead of running from darkness, you will discover that shadows create color and richness in your life. Once you learn how to abide and reckon with difficulties, you will succeed not in spite of your limitations, you will succeed because of them. The first four chapters of this book require some study to grasp the concepts, but the required effort will pay off. You will soar through the last four chapters as you apply the lessons in a life-changing way. Once you become familiar with the process and you are willing to use it with personal challenges, you will then be able to use it with others. People will seek your presence because they experience your peacefulness and lack of fear. You will become a healer. Our world desperately needs your healing presence.